to the Inquisitorial Representative, the Eleusidian Star Striders. My lord, the following concerns primarily the Eleusidian Star Striders, the private military cadre under the command of the rogue trader Eleusia Vrain of the Vrain Dynasty of Renown, but also covers events in the Galactic East and the Imperium more widely, with the Lord Gilliman's efforts at utilizing the rogue trader cohorts as the main element of a new phase of Imperial expansion and colonization following the formal ending of the Plague War, as well as the origins and nature of the Gellipox, which has rapidly become a galaxy-wide threat. As discussed previously, I have begun the arduous task of creating a complete history of this new Dark Age of the Imperium, spanning the events from the 13th Black Crusade and the fall of Cadia up to the present day, and attempting to encompass all of the events which have transpired in the last century and a half of strife. A generation is now ascending to the ranks of our illustrious organization, who have no knowledge of the time before the Great Rift, nor before the glorious return of our most honored Imperial Regent Gilliman. It is important that they appreciate that this new normal is not normal, and how quickly events can transpire that change the entire calculus of Imperial governance. As I compiled this vast treatise, a number of subjects have emerged which are important to know, but do not necessarily sit well within the overarching narrative I am constructing. I envisage these as complementary pieces to the whole, however, and they should slide neatly into the future completed history, so I will be sending them to yourself for further amendment and feedback now before they are disseminated to peer and partner organizations for educational purposes. Amongst the star-faring fleets of humanity are men and women given holy writ to explore those regions on the outskirts of the galaxy. Rogue traders are beholden to no mortal, and their decisions do shape history. These adventurers are entrusted with a sacred duty to claim new worlds in the name of the Emperor. The Imperium of Mankind is vast, its faded magnificence reaching across stars beyond reckoning. It encompasses a million worlds, yet these planets are spread far. So great are the distances between them that only travel through the immaterial dimensions of the Imperium allows the Imperium to remain connected. By using warp drives, starships can bypass the laws of physical space, traveling thousands of light years in a relatively short time. Such travel is wildly unpredictable, and swathes of territory are notoriously difficult or even impossible to reach. Yet despite the monumental distances between the Imperium's colonized worlds, and the fact that it has been in a state of war for all 10,000 years of its existence, it has grown to become the single largest empire in the galaxy, as is only right and just. Constant conflict has tempered mankind, readying us for the dark new era that we have now entered, an era in which humanity's very existence hangs in the balance. Some things never change. The Great Rift, an enormous tear in the fabric of reality, ripped the galaxy in two. Through that hellish fissure, the Chaos Gods sent forth their demon legions, seeking to conquer real space. In the period of darkness that immediately followed, the Noctis Eternia, more worlds were claimed by the Spectre of Damnation than ever before. Even now, the light of the Emperor's Astronomicon, the light by which ships travelling through the warp are guided, has returned to the galactic south. It is a time of desperation and encroaching doom. The leaders of the Imperium have issued a call to arms, putting its military and citizens on the ultimate war footing. To support the vast Imperial armies, whole star systems are being stripped of resources and materials, turned into armaments and sustenance. The Imperium's mobilizing call was directed not just at its workers and warriors, however. Those souls entrusted with extending the Emperor's domain have been charged with a nigh impossible task, to found new worlds just as fast as the Imperium is losing them to the manifold horrors of chaos. Amongst the most capable of those who ply outer space, in the name of the Imperium, are the individuals known as rogue traders, warriors, explorers, leaders, and merchants. Rogue traders are all of these and more. Their autonomy in Imperial society is rivaled only by those in the highest echelons of Terra and Mars's governments, and they can draw upon a vast selection of resources to accomplish that to which they are tasked, striking out into the void and finding new territory for mankind. They alone bear the sacred warrant of trade, a letter that empowers the owner and their descendants to travel beyond the boundaries of the Imperium and engage in both commerce and war. No two rogue traders are exactly alike, but all are charismatic and unconventional leaders, capable of rallying others to their cause and achieving their goals no matter the odds. To ply the black void so far from any form of support requires a rare mix of bravery, self-reliance, and wanderlust. Rogue traders almost always have an entourage, ranging from a tight group of family members to a 100-strong army of well-drilled, fanatically devoted killers. Over the course of their centuries-long careers, these masters of negotiation surround themselves with an array of specialists to account for every possible trial they could face on the borders of known space. These range from xenocultural experts, invaluable in making contact with sentient alien species and assessing how best the Imperium might kill them at a later date, to Medici staff who prolong their master's life far beyond their natural lifespan. Navigators, astropaths, explorator adepts, missionaries, soldiers, exotic creatures, and even Xenos advisors can be found in the service of rogue traders. These diverse retinues echo the elite operative groups chosen by Imperial Inquisitors, and are nigh as deadly, some would say. Each courtier is just as much a strike team as it is a diplomatic force, and there are few rogue traders who have never had to fight their way out of a tight spot. Every bit as important as acquiring skilled followers, a rogue trader needs a ship, preferably a small fleet of them. These are often the most formidable vessels that Imperial currency can buy, boasting cavernous vaults, donjon-like brigs, luxurious living quarters and firepower enough to level a city if the need arises. Yet the most precious assets of such a ship are not its guns, but the warp drive that allows it to make translation into the Imperium, and the potent Geller field that keeps it safe from demonic incursions whilst doing so. Alas, this is no foolproof process, for the warp is chaos incarnate, and humans are fallible and unpredictable creatures at the best of times. Elucia Vrain. A rogue trader always cuts an impressive figure, whether in the courts of Imperial High Society or upon a corpse-strewn battlefield. But none do so with more style than Elucia Vrain, even if she does say so herself. Resplendent in her baroque finery, she appears much like a well-to-do Quantrell, an appearance that is deliberately deceptive. Beneath her stylish apparel and confident demeanour lies the soul of a merciless and hyper-efficient predator, one whose claws are only sheathed until the moment of the kill. When her prey bares its throat or leaves even the slightest of openings, Elucia draws blur, her bejeweled cane rapier, and wields it with the deft quickness of a master duelist. The weapon's monomolecular edge shimmers with potent power, and although the blade is slim, it can cut through the thickest of armor with ease. With but the twitch of a trigger finger, she can riddle an enemy with bullets from her antique pistol, an heirloom from a more elegant period of humanity's long-forgotten past. At need, her ring finger can be flipped to reveal a priceless Jacaro digital weapon, then emits a blinding laser beam, shooting out from its faceted surface to scorch eyes and melt flesh. Vrain's potent war gear is not limited to offensive weaponry, as her armored corset houses within it the finest of disruption field generators. From las beams to plasma bursts, all manner of incoming fire dissipates against the sudden flash of its protective screen. Elusia Vrain comes from a long-established rogue trader dynasty, dating back to the 32nd millennium. Few rogue trader families can claim to have founded more imperial colonies than have the Vrains, earning them and their followers the moniker of Star Striders. Under her familial training, she has become an innate leader, and her quick thinking and rapid-fire decision-making has seen her escape from certain death many dozens of times. The Vrain dynasty of rogue traders remains tightly knit, typically working together in the Galactic North. However, Elusia herself has left her family behind. Whether this is by her choice or theirs is a question she will not answer. Whatever the case, Elusia's actions show she is determined to make her deeds stand out, even amongst the rich history of her ancestors. Her bold demeanor will see her rise to glory or die trying. Even by the standards of the High Lords of Terror, Vrain is old. She keeps in excellent health through the advanced medical procedures most recently performed by rejuvenant adept Sanastasia Minst, but accounts of her deeds span well over 500 years of Terran history. During her illustrious career, Vrain has discovered many star systems, mapped entire new sectors of the galaxy, and been credited with founding no less than a dozen different colonies. She helped eradicate the last of the Xeno species known as the Dehalok, and has earned the eternal favor of Mars for sending the tech priests, the coordinates leading to the planet Olimus, to date the most promethium-rich planet in the Imperium. Her adventures on the edge of the galaxy have not all gone smoothly, however. Several bounties have been placed on her head, and she is wanted for questioning by a number of branches of the Inquisition, mostly about the deaths of a string of planetary governors upon distant border worlds. These Imperial agents know her as the Mistress of the Black Flag, while the Orcs of the Dondar system refer to Elusia as Defeathered Death. The Aldari Corsairs of the Galactic North call her Failgail, a word that translates as either Huntress or She-Wolf. Star Strider, Scourge, Founder, Explorer, Savior, Destroyer. Vrain is all of these things and more. For now, that is all we will say. We will discuss her personal forces shortly. The Lord Regent's Summons. In the wake of the Great Rift, Elusia Vrain and nearly 100 other rogue traders were invited to Macragge for an emergency symposium. The summons bore the seal of Rabute Gilliman, an honour no one in the Imperium could refuse. It had been many thousands of years since so many rogue traders were gathered in one location. It was rare enough for a handful to meet. Vrain and many of her assembled fellows had guessed the purpose of the quorum by the time they had arrived, for Ultramar had been ravaged by war. The sovereign domain of the Ultramarines chapter, once thought inviolable, given its peerless infrastructure and many layered defences, had been broken open and brought to ruin on a dozen fronts by the demon Primarch Mortarion and his Death Guard, though Gilliman had returned to lead a masterful defense of his realm. The aftermath would take decades, if not centuries, to resolve. Many of the rogue traders genuflected as the Primarch entered the halls, but Gilliman bid them stand. He spoke to them as equals, as is his way. The Primarch claimed that the Imperium was not just being invaded, but locked in a struggle for its spirit as much as its body. The realm of Ultramar had been inflicted by plagues, each supernatural in origin and ferocious in its spread. Before the invading forces of Chaos had been driven back to the Scourge Stars, a trio of conquered Imperial systems, many of the moons and planets under Gilliman's rule, had been racked by the spore of Nurgle, the dark god that Mortarion and his fallen legion called Lord and Master. During the Indomitus Crusade, Gilliman had travelled across the war-riven galaxy and seen his father's empire in flames. He knew every resource would be needed to save mankind, and even as he took the fight to mankind's enemies, his statesmanlike mind dwelled on how the Imperium would recover from its losses. To this end, he knew the rogue traders would be vital. The rogue traders that Gilliman had selected were to fight for the Imperium's future, not as warriors or bureaucrats, but as pioneers. The front line upon which they would face their destiny was not that of the battlefield, but of deep and uncharted space. They were to find new worlds to conquer in the name of the Emperor, fresh lands upon which mankind could settle and thrive. While warp storms had cut off much of the galaxy, they had also opened up never-before-explored routes upon the fringes of the Imperium. There could be found opportunity, and such dangers that meant many of the rogue traders would never return. Gilliman gave those gathered at the symposium the opportunity to leave, to walk away without a stain on their honour, for it was a perilous task he proposed. Since the opening of the Great Rift, the Astronomicon had been occluded more than ever, and the creatures of the warp seemed to haunt every space lane and distant moon. Yet not one of those assembled took a backward step. Some remained out of pride, some out of duty, some out of a sense of adventure, but all were to find themselves set on a new path that would see them meet either victory or death. Within days, the fleets of the rogue traders had left the realm of Ultramar, bound for the yawning reaches of space beyond the eastern fringe and the extremities of the Ultra Segmentum spiral arm. Out there were the youngest stars in the galaxy, those most likely to have untouched planets in their orbits, and therefore most likely to have habitable lands. The fact that the tyrannic invasions of our galaxy is still occurring and for the most part coming from the galactic east, it doesn't appear to have crossed anyone's mind. That all hoped to find territories unspoiled by the ravages of chaos was an unspoken truth. Each rogue trader fleet took a different heading, their navigators guiding them through the warp towards destinations unknown. They all underwent challenges upon the way, and some found nothing but cruel and violent ends. Elucia Vrain took only her enormous flagship, the New Dawn, as she feared the multiple warp translations would make a larger fleet impossible to keep together. The journey to her intended destination was without incident, but throughout the journey, many aboard the vessel were plagued with vivid nightmares. The boilermen in the engine deck suffered worst of all, but such sleep abnormalities were common during warp travel, and even more so since the Great Rift had ripped a wound through reality, sending the stars into turmoil. It is at this point that I should state the importance of having commissars, or at least priests of the Ecclesiarchy, to monitor the spiritual health of a ship's crew, something that is rarely present upon the ships owned by rogue traders, perhaps due to their more libertine attitude to life and also unconventional lifestyles compared to the wider Imperium. Rogue trader Vrain tended towards pragmatism over superstition and paid divisions of her crew little mind when summoned from his secretive labours below decks. Her Electromeister advisor Larson van der Graus had insisted the ship's shields were at full strength. Furthermore, her close companion, the rejuvenant adept Sanastasia Minst, had vouched for the mental and physical health of every other soul aboard. The sense of disquiet reported by the ship's voidmaster Nitch, and the whines and growls of Aximilian, a genetically enhanced attack canid she had adopted and given over to her ship's voidsman-at-arms, may have once given Vrain pause, but in truth, she had become absorbed by her quest. The Vrain dynasty had long ago heard rumours of a resource-rich star system that lay far to the east of Macragge. Unbeknownst to all but her companion, Minst, and the silent death cult assassin, Nosso Prond, Lucia had in her possession a holo map showing the way to that promised land, stolen from her family's vaults prior to the galactic cataclysm, that it ensured her escape from immediate retribution. The star chart dated back to the age of technology, but since its rediscovery, every attempt to follow it had ended in failure, the way blocked by raging warp storms. The Great Rift's shockwaves, however, had changed the landscape of the galaxy, and if Elusia's sources were to be believed, the path was now open. On through the warp went the new dawn, year after year sliding by as the ship left the Astronomicon behind and made good progress towards the star that Vrain's holo map codified as Exostellus. The ennui and claustrophobia of life on the lower decks took its toll as months became years, but Vrain had Sanastasia to keep her in good health. Even a rejuvenant adept has her limits, however, and Vrain's body, already many times the longest of unaltered human lifespans, was beginning to resist the antithetonic treatments. Vrain begged the Engineerium boilermen that tended the warp engines to redouble their efforts, their claims of exhaustion and despair falling upon deaf ears. She would have her prize, no matter the cost. Then came the tolling of the bells. This was normally a welcome event, for it meant the long, nerve-wracking journey through the warp had ended, and translation back to real space had begun. However, something was wrong. The normally exuberant clanging, dirge-like and mournful. Yet there was little time to speculate, as the new dawn tore into reality, Auspex readings going haywire as the ship emerged into depths of space untouched by mankind for almost 20,000 years. From readings alone, the rogue trader knew she had found what she sought, an entire star system of inhabitable worlds ripe for the plucking. The readings of one world in particular were off the charts, and if they were to be believed, the planet was the most verdant Vrain had ever encountered. So it was that some 30 years after setting off from Ultramar, the new dawn moved into orbit to make planetfall. Naming the world Arcadia Neos, Vrain prepared for the long process of waking the settlers in the deep holds from stasis. She had found her paradise. Before the passing of a single Terran month, however, Vrain and her Elucidian Star Striders would be fighting for their very lives. With so many of their homeworlds contaminated, Primarch Gilliman had divided many of Ultramar's refugees amongst the fleets of the rogue traders he had tasked with expanding the Imperium's domain. Although nowhere near the hauling capacity of the large ships that headed the explorator fleets of the Tech Priests, the New Dawn still carried in its enormous holds thousands of citizens, along with hundreds of prefab buildings to help jumpstart the new colonies. With the journey expected to take decades, and the ships lacking the facilities and resources to accommodate so many live bodies, Vrain placed her human cargo into hyperfreeze. Most importantly, it ensured the inexperienced civilians would be spared the worst hardships of warp travel. Even with Vrain's map, the journey would consist of multiple translations, with a single jump through the Immaterium not able to be risked so far from the Astronomicon's guiding light. Such a journey could have taken longer if not for Vrain's unparalleled experience in deepest space. Despite its engine glitches and its crew having recurring nightmares, Elusia Vrain and the New Dawn had done it. They had navigated through sectors of space untraveled by mankind since the age of technology, the distant era from which her hollow map was dated. The papyrus map that Vrain had stolen from her family provided accuracy to within 3 parsecs, a very particularly odd way of measuring distance, if I may say so myself. Her fears that the system may have been discovered by Xenos races or contaminated by chaos during the millennia it had been lost to mankind were largely dispelled by the sensor readings being brought to her. From the ship's viewing gallery, Vrain looked down upon the glowing blue world, spending hours in contemplation. This was no smog-reefed hive world, sucked dry by industry and overpopulation, but a verdant gem, a sun-warmed utopia, surrounded by other inhabitable worlds. Already the rogue trader's quick mind planned out which moons would best serve as defense stations, which continents would best be suited to immediate colonization. In that moment, the blue tinge of Arcadia seemed the very color of hope itself. Despite her joy over finding the pristine world, Elusia Vrain was pragmatic, a trait that had kept her alive many times throughout her tumultuous career on the galaxy's fringes. All about her, the New Dawn hummed with awakening life. The settlers were coming out of stasis, and it would take a Terran week for them to fully recover and prepare the prefabricated structures crammed within the New Dawn's immense hangars. During that time, Elusia Vrain and her core followers would make planetfall to take further readings and establish landing zones for the first colonies. From the surface, more detailed scans not only met the hopes raised by orbital readings, but exceeded them. Arcadia Neos was rich in life and minerals, with data showing no sign of sentient Xenos races amongst the vibrant flora and fauna. Unlike a death world, the apex predators there proved to be of little danger to armed warriors. Upon Vrain's command, a message of triumph sang out into the void, sent by the New Dawn's astropath to his counterpart on Macragge. In the period that followed, Elusia Vrain, her crew, and the settlers ferried down to the planet on many a shuttle journey. Only the engine master and his crew remained aboard the New Dawn. The source of the dirge-like bells had been determined to be a malfunction in the ship's warp drive, and the lower decks were cordoned off while repairs were begun. Such issues were of little immediate concern to Vrain, as she was too busy coordinating the founding of the colonies and the exploration of nearby moons. The perfect, unassailable dream of Arcadia Neos ended in a single night. Unnatural beasts emerged from one of the prefab buildings, draining a dozen settlers of blood before being hunted down. Contrary to assumptions, Sanastasia Mintz's autopsies revealed that the fiends were not indigenous to Arcadia Neos, and were instead nothing more than common human parasites. Mites, boroflies and the like, grown to abnormal size. Their signatures were traced back to the New Dawn. On a slight but nagging suspicion, Lucia Vrain gathered a hand-picked team of the Star Striders aboard the transport shuttle True Hawk and returned to the orbiting starship. She took with her Voidmaster Nitch's squad of Voidsmen-at-Arms. Voidsmen-at-Arms are trained extensively in the use of the Lasgun, the ubiquitous anti-personnel weapon that also serves as the common armament of the Imperium's largest military force, the Imperial Guard. The naval soldiers are regularly drilled, both to keep themselves sharp during long voyages, and also to ensure the indentured toiler class of workers that service the many needs of the starship are kept in line. Voidsmen form the last line of protection should their ship be breached, but they are not merely defensive in nature. Voidsmen are trained to conduct counter-boarding exercises and act as escorts to officers or specialists, should they decide to make planetfall. When a Voidsman-at-Arms is assigned to their host ship, there is no going back. From that day on, they are part of that vessel, and that vessel is part of them. They partake of the ship's vital fluids in a solemn ceremony, drinking incense-laced oil so that the craft's essence flows through their bloodstream, just as they move through the arterial corridors and passageways of their new home. Quite quaint, really. Upon induction, they swear a simple but significant oath to slay, without hesitation, any force that threatens their ship, its crew, or any Imperial dignitaries the craft might carry. This oath is held sacrosanct, even when the Voidsman is on planetary leave or assigned to an expedition. It is not uncommon for the service of Voidsmen-at-Arms to be requisitioned by vital Imperial agents, such as Inquisitors or Rogue Traders. Their new duties might entail leaving their assigned ship for months or even years at a time, but their oath will still hold true. They must defend their officers and fellows with steely determination, no matter the cost. In many ways, the Voidsman's life is a simple one, shorn of moral ambiguity and the doubt that haunts the higher ranks of the Imperium. Their imperative is clear. The ship, along with its crew, cargo, and passengers, must be protected against all manner of enemies, be they traitor forces, Xenos pirates, or abominable demons. In battle, a Voidsman-at-Arms looks first to their Lasgun. When grouped into a squad, they are more than capable of laying down hails of Lasfire, withering enemy ranks and keeping the foe at bay. Although trained in close combat and protected by Baroque flak armor, it is standard Imperial Navy tactics to keep enemies at arm's length and punish them with massed firepower. Yet, battles do not often adhere to plans, and for close-ranged fighting, such as that taking place during boarding actions, each Voidsman also carries a las pistol. Crowded ship corridors with their sudden turns and enclosed spaces are also the perfect environment for the Voidsman's concussion grenades. These hand-thrown bombs carry a charge that detonates with a resounding explosion, a burst that is even more dangerous within enclosed areas. Many a surging breakthrough attack has been halted with the judicious use of a few well-placed grenades. To augment a squad's firepower, it is common practice for one member to carry a heavier armament. The standard choice is the rotor cannon. With its multi-barrels and high rate of fire, the weapon has earned a number of monikers. The Wer-Gun, Deck Clearer, and the Emperor's Chainsaw, to name but a few. Voidsmen are typically led by experienced troopers promoted from within their own ranks. These individuals are known as Void Masters, and are sometimes referred to in more archaic terms such as petty or warrant officers. It is the Void Master that barks out commands and ensures discipline is maintained, whether the squad is in battle or simply running through another grueling training regimen. In place of a lasgun, these officers carry an artificer shotgun, a weapon that can be devastating in close quarters. Void Masters are noted for their practicality and gruff personas, characterized by their stern disposition and unwavering adherence in Imperial Navy codes. They uphold many of the traditions and rituals that have been in place since before the days of the Horus Heresy, whether on weapons cleaning duties, deck polishing, or volley fire practice. Woe to the trooper that fails to live up to a Void Master's exacting expectations. Void Master Nitch and his squad became part of the Elucidian Star Striders when they were seconded from the Vengeance, in exchange for the aid rendered to their task force by Elucia Vrain. Strict and professional in his duties, Nitch is nevertheless well-liked by his men. Even the most begrudging of their group admits that the vigour in training and constant discipline that the Void Master preaches has paid off in battle more than once. Additionally, Nitch backs up his relentless pursuit of military excellence with numerous acts of loyalty and bravery under fire. There is no member of the squad Nitch has not impressed with his actions. The Voidsmen still talk of the time he stepped between the squad and a boarding mob of orcs upon the Vengeance, the Void Master's artificer shotgun blasting apart the Greenskin's charge. Vrain herself has complimented Nitch, as well as remarking upon his squad's ability to lay down an impressive spread of supporting fire. Of Nitch's Voidsman squad, weapons specialist Stromian Grell is the most veteran, having served alongside the Void Master on 3 separate voyages. Once a hot-headed recruit, Grill has absorbed the lessons Nitch so often shouts, and he now remains calm in battle by repeating mantras taught by the Ecclesiarchy. By laying down effective fire in several engagements, Grell has earned the right to bear the squad's rotor cannon. The rest of the squad contains Voidsman Shelkus, the deadliest shot with the las pistol, Voidsman Rigors, a noted pessimist whose griping earns constant rebuke from Nitch, and Voidsman Theolus, the youngest and most eager to prove himself. Many ancient Terran species still survive on planets settled during the Age of Technology, and only recently rediscovered. On one such world, Elucia Vrain found a creature belonging to a domesticated species from the distant past, a canid. Naming the beast Aximilian, she brought it aboard the New Dawn, where it quickly bonded with the Voidsmen at Arms. They trained and outfitted the canid as one of their own, its heightened senses ensuring that not even foes hidden by cloaking technology could approach unnoticed. Aximilian moves with impressive speed and can deliver a powerful bite. Many times the canid has proven both an excellent guardian and loyal companion to all those within the Elucidian Star Striders. Several of Vrain's most important advisors and specialists also accompanied this mission. Electromeister Larsen von der Graus. The Electromeisters have a powerful and innate connection with the motive force, and sacred electricity literally runs through their veins. So thoroughly do these priests of energy understand their trade that even the fractious electro-priests of the cult Mechanicus treat them as prophets of the Omnisire. Unusually amongst their priesthood, Electromeisters are entrusted with claiming the crackling energies of unexplored territories. In many ways, they are missionaries of the Martian Creed, always searching for new sources of energy that can be exploited to help fuel prospective forge worlds. They are, to raw electrical force, what an ecclesiarchal priest is to a planet full of heathens, ripe for conversion. And with that responsibility comes a great deal of power indeed. To aid them in their mission, a Lectromeister has an array of technological marvels at their fingertips. The generator they wear upon their back, optimized via a turn screw handset, generates a powerful Voltgeist field that sends out crackling wraiths of energy whenever the Lectromeister is threatened. These bursts of electricity prematurely detonate solid shot projectiles and dissipate energy bolts. Even a fusillade of bolter fire can rarely penetrate such an aegis. Should the Lectromeister be attacked by primitives he intends to relieve of their precious resources, the pyroelectrics of this defense shield alone can cow the heathens and convince them that potent spirits are at the priest's command. In many ways, this is not too far from the truth. The Lectromeister's powers are not limited to defense, for their arsenal of weaponry includes a Voltaic blaster, a weapon of the Adeptus Mechanicus that can shock a target's animating energies from his body. If the Lectromeister has a weakness, it is without doubt their dangerous curiosity. Many of their kind take up with explorator fleets or rogue traders, hoping to find unexploited worlds rich in untapped energy. It is their driving desire and mania to be able to send back detailed reports of great riches to their forge world of origin. Alas, out in the furthest and most savage reaches of the galaxy, most such seekers find only jeopardy and death instead. It has only been a few years since the Lectromeister Larson van der Graus joined the Eleusian Star Striders, while scouting for sources of the motive force from his homeworld of Mars. Van der Graus was urged by his superiors to forsake his voltless searches along the eastern fringe in order to join the expeditions of the rogue trader. After all, Vrain had discovered the promethium-rich planet of Olimus, and was seen by Mars as one of the most influential and likely to discover treasures of all rogue traders. Since that time, Larson van der Graus has traded his technical expertise and the impressive protections of his Voltgeist array for a chance to travel at Vrain's side across the frontier. Detailed reports, in static code, stream constantly back from van der Graus to Mars, keeping the tech priests appraised of the rogue trader's every move. And of course, keeping us appraised as well, for the arrogant tech priests have yet to realize that we have broken their ciphers for this little agent of theirs. And this is one of the main reasons why I'm able to present this information to you today. Sanastasia minced. Rejuvenant Adepts are members of an Imperial organization modeled after the Order's Hospitaller, but are not only focused on healing, but also longevity. They hold the power of a sham immortality, and their talents are greatly sought after by those with the resources to pay for them, with complex programs of rejuvenant treatments, steroidal elixirs, and anti-thanators. These bioscientists can extend the lifespans of the wealthiest patrons for centuries past their natural limit. Without these specialist personnel, even the High Lords of Terror would feel the cold claw of death clutching at their throats before their generation-spanning agendas could come close to completion. Rejuvenant Adepts can be found throughout many Imperial agencies, but they are of special use to rogue traders. All voyages of the stars routinely make journeys that take several decades or longer to complete, even when translating into the warp. Such odysseys are grueling for the mind as well. as the body, the extreme form of cabin fever, known as Empyrean Fugue, is a very real danger for those effectively trapped in the Immaterium for any length of time. Trusted with the well-being of their charges, the rejuvenant adepts are also masters of neural realignment, their normalizer helms allowing them to exude waves of calm that can render even the most hideous waking nightmare a swiftly fading memory. On the battlefield, rejuvenant adepts are incredibly proficient at effecting emergency surgeries. Within the blink of an eye, they can heal serious wounds and administer pain-numbing agents. Even warriors felled due to punctured organs, torn muscles, or broken bones can be not only stabilized, but ameliorated. Even those who have been seemingly mortally wounded can once more take up arms and rejoin the battle. The members of the Ordos Hospitaller take vows of non-violence, dedicating themselves to healing alone. Such is not the case with rejuvenant adepts. The galaxy is full of war, and these specialized medics are under no illusions that battle and bloodshed will not be required of them at some point. When called upon to engage an enemy, an adept's las pistol and scalpel claw allow them to more than hold their own, ending lives as willingly as they would extend them. Sanastasia Minst was once the preeminent rejuvenant adept in the Talisar sector. Tragically, her meteoric rise to power was reversed just as she had begun to make a name for herself. After successfully treating the skin rot of the Dothar aristocracy, the ensuing ravages of the disease were erased. Minst began to have waking dreams of a maiden trapped in a cage, and forced to suffer eternally by contracting and then overcoming a potent new disease each day. She became obsessed with the idea of a panacea, a cure-all that could heal even a god. It was this fixation that saw Sanastasia begin to neglect her duties of rejuvenation. When the High Princess, Curtly Dotha, began to show signs of her 180-year lifespan, Sanastasia was forced to flee. She took up with Elusia Vrain, leaving the Ultramar system on the New Dawn in the hope of beginning afresh. It worked for a while, until the vessel plied the depths of the warp, where something spoke to Sanastasia, promising her an innate understanding of all diseases and the cures that could banish them. All she had to do was sabotage a certain panel of a certain warp drive, and the knowledge would be hers. I'm sure once this little nugget of information was discovered, everything worked out fine for her. Nosso Prond. There are many different sects of Imperial Death Cult, but all are obsessed with the act of killing. After all, in a hostile galaxy, only the strongest will survive. Hence the cult's glorification of all things that bring death to the enemies of the Imperium. Although some are branded as heretical, most sects within the Death Cult remain faithful to the Emperor, for they revere him as a figure beyond the grave's cold clutches, and seek a portion of his immortal wisdom by steeping themselves in his morbid energies. For a Death Cult executioner, the act of living is a blasphemy, only balanced by the tally of souls they reap. It is their calling to slay, and they seek to kill not only the Emperor's enemies, such as Xenos or traitors, but also those who would better serve the Imperium through death. By their reasoning, an assembly line worker that can no longer keep pace is occupying a vital space that could be better filled. It is the Death Cult's rampant culling of citizens no longer deemed worthy that draws the ire of the Inquisition. That, and the cannibalism that often follows. Death Cults can be found across the Imperium and beyond, Some cults demand their members journey upon a blood crusade, while others hire out their trained killers, allowing the cult to better finance themselves, while opening up new channels for bloodletting. They are in much demand by rogue traders, inquisitors, and other more unseemly types. I've hired some myself in the past. Death cult executioners prefer to deliver a death blow at close quarters, the better to drink in the energies of their kill. The art of the blade is paramount to death cult executioners, and they master many combat styles and different types of incisions. All have special significance in the sacred kill, decreeing differing levels of respect or dishonor. Yet a sword is not the assassin's only weapon. In addition to its enhanced optics and rebreather, the executioner's mask can spit a poison needle with incredible accuracy. As much as I enjoy employing them, they are a tad heretical, I'm sure you'll agree. Strange are the ways of the death cults. Rising to the upper echelons of her cult, the Winged Skull, Nosso Prond was forced by the political maneuverings of her own priestesses to take a cruel vow to strike out into the galaxy, unable to speak a word or return to her temple until she had slain a specimen of no less than 1,000 different Xenos races. After years of hunting, Nossus crossed paths with Elucia Vrain by wordlessly offering her services to the rogue trader. Prond was able to travel the fringes of the galaxy, bringing her face to face with a huge number of exotic alien species, greatly increasing her kill tally. Although silent, Prond has developed a strong rapport with the rogue trader and acts as her champion. As Vrain and her team entered the ship, at first, nothing seemed amiss. But as her crew picked their way towards the engine decks, signs of corruption became more readily visible. Strange secretions dripped off the walls, and a fetid and unnatural odor filled the winding corridors. More of the grotesquely swollen parasites were discovered. Something vile had taken hold of the ship. The further Vrain's team explored, the more corridors seemed like the infected innards of some sickly beast. The deep clunking of the engines was no longer a steady thud, but the irregular double beat of a dying man's heart. Upon reaching the cathedral-like engineerium, Vrain gazed with revulsion upon the black heart of the new dawn's corruption. What was once the ship's warp drive was now a tumorous flesh mass that pumped vile fluids through the ship. The rogue trader ordered a hasty retreat back to the shuttle, pausing only to unleash a steady stream of lasgun fire at the shadowy figures that lurched behind them. Once they had been the engineering crew, but now they were the stuff of nightmares. Only when her team had boarded the Truehawk and exited the holds of the New Dawn did Elucia punch in the codes to activate the ship's remote self-destruct function. Handy thing to have. As the data transmitted, the shuttle's klaxon blared, its siren punctured by Aximilian's alarm barks and a fusillade of lasgun fire. Bursting from beneath the floor panels and pulling themselves out of the ducts, came cybernetic mutants, their static-laced moans as disturbing as their appearance. Having stowed away while Vrain and her team searched the new dawn, they now sprang their ambush. Vrain's first instinct was to get the Truehawk planetside, where she could call upon more troops, but she quelled the urge. There was no way she wanted to risk spreading the contamination further. The mutants would have to be dealt with aboard the shuttle. Based on reports from survivors of this scene, we can determine what she was up against. Amstein Volg was once a strapping engine master and commander of the engine decks, but the Gellapox virus had warped him. He was now a twisted lord, known as Volgra Thrice Cursed, or simply Old Boiler Guts. While the corrupted Gelafil generator bestowed many darksome gifts upon the engine crew, none were granted more than Volg. The engine master swelled massively in size, his new form supported by bulging muscles and a dark, pulsating vitality. In a disturbing ceremony, the writhing bodies of his first two mates became absorbed within his own flesh, and thus did Volg become the three-headed Volgra. Horrific to look upon, the Twisted Lord sprouted new limbs and developed an ability to skin-graft weapons into his body, merging man and machine with gruesome results. Not all of the New Dawn accepted their gifts willingly. In combat against such non-believers, Volgra proved more than a match for even the most veteran amongst them, his multiple weapon-tipped limbs pummeling and ripping apart any who dared oppose him. Yet Volgra saved his most dangerous weapon until he was confronted by 24 Voidsmen-at-Arms. Shrugging off Lasgun fire, the Twisted Lord exposed his distended gut to reveal a raging fire burning within. His belly had become a disease-ridden furnace that was stoked by hatred. With a grunt, Volgra issued forth a gout of corrupting fire, an unnatural inferno that engulfed his enemies. None survived, and their blackened bones now help fuel the flickering flames that still burn within the Twisted Lord. Volgra is a boisterous leader, looking after not only those mutants beneath him, but also the infected Gelafil generator that gifted him with his new abilities. It was he who first succumbed to its call, and who gathered others of the crew to perform debased rituals. Those that dissented from this new path were quickly shown the error of their ways. At first, the infected had been like a carbuncle on the underbelly of their host culture, but eventually it was they who ruled the ship. In all his zealous actions to grow his beloved cult, Volgra still showed elements of his old engine master self, cooing over well-made mechanisms and expressing appreciation for the solid craftsmanship of the machines and mutations that surrounded him. The following are the examples of the different variants of Gelapox-infected mutants, which were present during these events. But in other examples of Gelapox infections, similar breeds have been noted. So we can deduce that where the virus strikes, similar mutations will flow. The Gelapox virus elevates an engineering crew's natural reverence for the life-saving technology they maintain to a new and disturbing level, and before long they come to worship the Gelafil generator. Throughout their escalating veneration, they fail to realize that the drive has been compromised and now hosts a vile warp entity. Over time, the crew absorbs baleful emanations emitted from the corrupted machinery and becomes mutated. In a final submission to chaos, the bewitched crew rest their heads upon the Gelafil generator's housing, the better to commune with the animus inside. The steel of that giant machine flows like quicksilver around their heads, encasing their craniums in immaterium-tainted metal. When struck in battle, those Gelacorst masks flash, sending warp-saturated energy bursts outwards, with enough force to shred the sanity of anyone in close quarters. In addition to these disturbing masks, the mutants are afflicted with foul boils, horrifically bloated bellies, necrotic skin and malformed limbs, often one or more of which take the form of tentacles, scythes, or other weird lumpen shapes. Strangely, the Gelapox disease can affect machinery and will often fuse man with machine, grafting weapons into mutant appendages. The speech of Gelapox mutants is garbled, muffled by mask, but also made near intelligible by mechanical whirs, bleeps, and static. In a similar fashion, two others blessed by Nurgle's dubious gifts. Bearers of the Gellipox are notoriously resistant and can shrug off what would otherwise prove to be mortal wounds. Lumbering from the underdecks of the New Dawn came a gruesome horde. Mechanics and mates that had once served Volg had been transformed into Gellipox mutants who answered to Volgrar, thrice cursed. They were the Vox Shamblers, Grummex, Puglox, and the Herg, twisted variants of their former selves, who now acted as the Twisted Lord's apostles, spreading the virus aboard the New Dawn. Those unblessed by Nurgle were beaten and given one last chance to bow before the sickly coloured Gellifield generator. One final chance to recognise the divine machinery that pulsed before them. In battle, the Vox Shamblers are terrifying and tenacious foes. As they march, from beneath their masks comes a garbled speech that mixes words given shape by swollen, cyst-covered tongues. With bursts of static machine code, Vox signals and mechanical whirs and clicks, they can absorb prodigious amounts of firepower, barely even slowing in their efforts to get close and deliver their own devastating blows. Glitchlings are small demons, close cousins to the entities known as Nurglings, a fusion of machine plague and electrostatic energy. The mites were first reported in M32, shortly after the demon Primarch Perturabo made a pact with Nurgle that saw him pervert the 8 rituals of possession and turn them against the Forge world of toil. That planet was conquered, not only by the Iron Warriors, but also by the Tech Priest's own machines, their trusted engines becoming nightmarish cybernetic horrors that were as much demonic flesh as metal. Waddling among the machine beasts were plump, diminutive creatures that cackled in scrap code and glowed with baleful energy. Even as the guns of the Forge World's defenders focused on larger targets, the glitchlings ran wild. Their disruptive aura caused cogitators, electro-lumens, and machine spirits to falter or go haywire. In their moment of greatest need, the defenders found their weapons stuttering and flickering as the machine plague took its toll. Similar strange anomalies have been recorded across the galaxy since the fall of toil. Wherever the glitchlings bounce forth, long-cherished guns in fine working order suddenly fail. The most reliable servitors stumble to a grinding halt, and tanks in pristine condition suddenly rust as if aged hundreds of years in the blink of an eye. Such is the glitchling's true purpose, to bring entropy and disease to machines, infecting circuitry, contaminating mechanical parts and degrading metal, rather than bringing plague to creatures of flesh and blood. Although their greatest joy is in disrupting the technology of mortal races, glitchlings are malicious creatures, and they find it immensely entertaining to stab or bite foes that are distracted by their weapons malfunctioning. Although small and relatively puny, glitchlings secrete a noxious substance that covers their claws, teeth, and blades, so that any wounds they cause are full of infectious disease. Burbling nonsensical words and emitting spark-filled belches, the gregarious glitchlings bound across the battlefield in small packs. They take extraordinary glee in spreading mayhem and express puerile behaviour in the form of rude gestures, suggestive capers, and tittering laughter over the pain and destruction they leave in their wake. They mock and mimic the curses or looks of shock that come over defenders as their trusted weapons inexplicably falter at precisely the worst moment. The exact connection between the glitchlings and the Gellipox virus is unknown, but each breakout thus far recorded has been accompanied by a host of diminutive mischief-makers. Some warp-born mutations are more pronounced than others. Those referred to as Nightmare Hulks have reached the apogee of transformation that a mortal frame can withstand before it bursts apart in a fountain of gore or becomes a chaos spawn. Each over 10 foot tall and weighing well over a ton, nightmare hulks are so far past the limits of normality that only the tiniest shreds of sanity and intellect are left to them. Such lumbering mutants are much prized in the vassal hosts of chaos, for they are past notions of fear, and exist simply to rend and tear, in the manner of a frenzied beast. Many a headlong charge against an imperial fortress has been led by a line of rampaging nightmare hulks, eyes bulging and muscles straining. Heedless of their own forces' casualties, they smash into bunker doors and crush Varrokeet with their jagged claws and grasping tentacles. The sheer hideousness of the nightmare hulks is a weapon in itself, for they boast all manner of disease deformities, growths, and disgusting features. Extra mouths gnash, tentacles writhe, plentiful folds of skin sway and bulge ominously, as if something inside was writhing its way out. The sight of these monstrosities alone can drive a spike of crippling fear into even the most stalwart of hearts. Many are the foes that dropped weapons and fled in horror at the approach of something so gruesome and unnatural. Permanently enraged, nightmare hulks hurtle towards the nearest foe, eager to smash their victims to bloody paste. Some carry crude weapons, but most prefer to attack with their powerful claws, throttle with their sucker-lined tentacles, or even swallow adversaries whole. The largest and most powerful of their kind are known as colossal hulks, and their ferocity is second to none. It is not mankind alone that suffers mutation due to the twisting powers of chaos. A long list of parasites have plagued those that travel the stars. But when subjected to enough of the vile energies of the warp, such organisms grow from disturbing nuisances to the most vile of predators. A variety of freakish creatures scamper, buzz, and sliver amongst a mutant horde. These organisms were once parasites that suckled unseen upon humanity, but after being bathed in warp energy, they have grown to the size of canids. As their statures have increased, so too have their appetites. They charge headlong towards prey, hissing and chittering as they seek to sate their never-ending hunger. The dirty-bodied flies that buzz from the corpses of chaos-infected cadavers are often imbued with a tiny portion of warp energy. These insects become steel-sharp of proboscis and swollen of abdomen, their spindly legs like barbed needles that sink into the skin of their targets. Eye stinger swarms are fast, able to dart, dodge, and change direction in mid-air, making them extremely difficult targets. They are amongst the most feared warp parasites, for they attack their victims' faces, knowing that to blind and terrify their prey is to ensure a far easier meal. With a repellent droning, the mutated flies will work in unison, their proboscis stabbing at their victims' eyes. Those whose skin has been punctured during the attack soon find their flesh rippling with ocular organs bulging outwards. Noxious maggots emerge from their bodies within seconds, burrowing their way out to reveal foul new broods of eye stingers. The hopping, leaping insect, known as curse mites, were once minuscule blood drinkers that were little more than a painful nuisance. However, having fed upon the distorting powers of chaos, such parasites grow huge. They are still drawn to the scent of gore, and they spring forward with shocking swiftness to bowl over their prey. Once their stabbing mouthparts find an artery, curse mites can drain a man-sized host of blood in seconds. As they feast, the parasites' bodies balloon, swelling in size even as they turn crimson. Only after draining a foe of every drop of blood will they fall off. But this sated state lasts mere seconds before they are bounding off again in search of another living meal. The leech-like creatures known as sludge grubs are swollen and grotesque. They slither from dank hiding places to batten on their victims. Their fang-lined maws capable of delivering a deep and nasty bite. Once attached, sludge grubs are all but impossible to remove. It is dangerous to even try, for in bursting their soft bodies one risks being splattered by their extremely caustic innards. Mutated by the warp, sludge grubs are filled with an acidic fluid that can burn through any armor. The loathsome parasites can spit small sticky globules of this substance a short distance, allowing a pack of them to fell larger prey upon which to feed. These myriad abominations now attacked Vrain's crew. Vrain rushed out of the bridge, locking the bulkhead behind her, only to emerge into an escalating battle. At the open door to the cargo bay, the voidsmen at arms were attempting to hold back the mutants. Their fire was accurate. The fusillades of lasbeam struck the foe, blasting through distended guts and bloated torsos, but failing to slow their enemies at all. Weapons specialist Stroman Grell leveled his rotor cannon to blast apart the oncoming mutants in explosions of foul fluid. Vrain joined the defense, expertly picking off several of the lurching attackers with her heirloom pistol. As the cyber mutants advanced, the lights flickered as fat-bodied demon mites darted out of overturned crates. The voidsman closest turned to blast them apart, only to find his lasgun inexplicably malfunctioning as they fell upon him in their multitudes, his horrible screams mercifully cut short. Even as Vrain realized it was too late to stem the tide of foes emerging from hiding, a hulking giant stormed out of the shadows. Death cult assassin Nosso Prond was swift to claim its head, but another came, using its crushing strength to smash a command console. The True Hawk lurched, tilting everyone in first one direction and then another. A stray rotor cannon shot burst a pipe, sending out obscuring clouds of steam that momentarily hid the foe. The ship's internal gravity began to fail, and Vrain could hear metal bending as other monstrous creatures battered upon the closed blast shutters. Vrain knew there was but one possible recourse now, and with a shout, she ordered her team to abandon ship and make their way to the escape pods. The fight to reach the True Hawk's escape pods was costly. Three of the escape craft had been jettisoned from the True Hawk. The fourth had not made it, its passengers overwhelmed by mutants. The high-orbit explosion of the new dawn was bright enough to be seen through Arcadia Neos's sun. Additionally, contrails of escape pods joined those from the True Hawk, raining down upon the planet's surface, a telltale sign that not all those aboard the new dawn had perished. Lucia Vrain and her comrades steered their plummeting pods towards the first buildings of the colony. The rogue trader's craft was damaged as it left the True Hawk, and its malfunctioning guidance system caused it to crash into the largest of the structures, the Adeptus Ministorum Shrine. The meteoric descent through the roof further damaged the pod, its door jammed shut. How long Vrain lay stunned, she did not know. Upon recovering, she immediately sought to cut her way out of the escape pod. She had no way of knowing if others of her team had lived, and although she had not seen the additional contrails, the rogue trader deemed it likely that some of the infected had survived the destruction of the new dawn. Even now, they might be closing upon her. Volgra, thrice-cursed, seethed over the loss of his beloved Gellerfield generator, and swore vengeance on those who had destroyed it. Many of his infected cult had still been aboard the new dawn when its reactors detonated, and Volgra felt their loss keenly. Some of the new dawn's landing pods had jettisoned before the ship buckled and ripped itself apart. Each was filled with mutants, the nightmare hulks taking the room of five ordinary men. Even mutoid vermin had scampered in, both eager to be by the side of their larger allies and simply hoping to find rich new sources of blood. Although the landings were widely scattered, the mutants pulled themselves out and began striding towards the largest buildings on the horizon. They longed for vengeance and to spread their new disease. By the time the first of Elucia Vrain's team entered the Ministerium Shrine, the infected were already pouring in. The strange mutoid vermin could be seen prowling along the edges of the shadows within the dimly lit building. The footsteps and voices of voidsmen echoed beneath the vaulted ceiling as they called out for their leader. But their only answer was the sickly drone of eye stinger swarms. Lasgun fire flashed as the insects surged towards the Imperial soldiers. One voidsman at arms, Riguz, found out the hard way that the visor of his helm would not stop the stinging proboscis of the loathsome parasites. His anguished cries as mutant larvae burst out of his eyes were mercifully cut short by a swift strike from the merciless Nosso-Prond. Even as the last sound of the dying voidsman faded, the static-filled moaning of Gellipok's mutants could be heard, along with the roaring of the larger of their corrupted kin. So began the battle proper, with voidsmen searching for the fallen pod while loosing volleys at the loathsome creatures in the shadows. With a shout of triumph, the pod was found, and several voidsmen rushed from cover in an attempt to open it. They were met by an oncoming nightmare hulk, a towering mutant that stood nearly twice the height of a man. Great tentacle arms snaked out to batter down one voidsman, while another was lifted up and choked. Rejuvenant adept Sanastasia Minst quickly administered to the fallen warrior, while the Electromeister Larsen von der Graus blasted at the jammed pod door with his Voltaic pistol. More voidsmen arrived, levering bright bursts of lasfire into the massive mutant. Despite many shots landing, the nightmare hulk could seemingly absorb the shots with impunity. Stromian Grell's rotor cannon proved more capable, and he swept the whirring gun back and forth, stitching red ruin across the tentacled monstrosity. It staggered and fell, yet still dragged its bulk forward with its snake-like appendages. Screaming his fury, Grell aimed another salvo and then looked down at his gun in shock. Jammed. Even as he cursed, the glitchlings that had snuck underfoot swarmed closer, giggling sparks and gnashing their razor-sharp teeth. The canid Aximilian arrived too late to save Grell, but he did avenge the fallen voidsman by savaging the tittering demon mites. It was then that a new assault wave began, with a trio of Gellipok's mutants rushing forwards, followed closely behind by another nightmare hulk. Vrain escaped her confines just in time. Darting out from her pod, she slashed with her monomolecular blade, Blur. For a moment, the bloated Gellipok's mutants halted as if stunned, before their cleanly severed limbs and heads began to topple. The metal mask of the last mutant flashed unnaturally as the rogue trader stabbed Blur through it. So potent was the psychic feedback it unleashed that Vrain was momentarily stunned, even as a new wave of curse mites bounded forward, eager for blood. Minst was faster, however. Her hastily administered serum cleared Vrain's head instantly, so that the rogue trader's snapshots each sent one of the oncoming parasites sprawling, their foul whip-like legs twitching aimlessly in their death throes. Meanwhile, the death cult assassin squared off with the nightmare hulk. Nosso-Prond swung out with her power blade, chopping a scything claw from the corrupted giant and then darted out of the way before the creature's return blow could strike her down, dodging even the geyser of befouled blood that spurted from the creature's stump. Then came the leader of the Gellipok infected, the architect behind the new dawn's corruption, apparently, Amidst the bellowing flames, the creature known to his subjects as Old Boiler Guts strode into the shrine, roaring his displeasure. All around the shrine came the static groans of his answering minions, roused for one last charge. Vrain's last stand was nigh. It culminated in a single combat between Vrain and Old Boiler Guts. In one stunning move, she managed to slit the throats of all three of his heads. And with that, the final purge of his minions began. We do not know the current state of the colony. Perhaps it does still survive and has prospered. What we do know is that Vrain has been sighted abroad, so she has clearly gained access to her other naval assets. I hope that this exploration of the Star Striders has been illuminating, as it does cover a number of interesting topics. Some of these issues will be covered again in greater detail in the History of the Dark Age of the Imperium, and you can expect other short treatises on related subjects very soon. In the meantime, my lord, I await with anticipation your feedback. As ever, I am your most loyal and patient servant, Inquisitor A.B. Prince. Thanks for watching, everybody. Please do remember to like the video and subscribe if you're not subscribed. Much more stuff coming very, very soon. To everybody supporting the channel, you can see your names here. Thanks a lot, lads. Really means a lot, genuinely. It's great. So, yeah, thank you. I will see you again soon. And, yeah, have a good one. Cheers.